Hello, and welcome to episode number 29 of the CG Garage podcast with Mr. Rob Niederhorst, okay. Otherwise known as Throb.
That's right. There you go.
Throb,
yeah. You know Throb, right?
I know Throb.
Yeah, everyone knows Throb.
Yeah. A couple of ibuprofen. And
if it throbs, just get a couple of ibuprofen.
A couple of Advil.
It's good. Good to go. So Rob Niederhorst is a veteran of the industry, to say the least, right?
Yeah, lost his legs in the war.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's true.
And yet he's still as tall as he used to be.
That's
Throb.
It's good. That's good. And Throb also happens to, he actually wrote part of Nuke in the early days.
Right? He did.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's actually been doing this for a long time. Well, very, very knowledgeable, extremely knowledgeable, has mentored a bunch of people,
mm-hmm.
and he's actually one of the first people to bring V-Ray to DD. Actually, I introduced Throb to V-Ray, and he was the one that pushed for it to happen. So we talk about that on the podcast, which is pretty cool. We also mention his new endeavors, which I think is interesting. You should that you're here, Daryush. It's about education.
Yeah, actually, he and I had a very nice conversation about it.
Yeah.
Something I'd probably be a part of, actually.
Really? You're going to do one of the live mentor things?
I will, yeah.
Okay, so the website should be going up live, and it's called Live Mentor, and the URL is live-mentor.com.
Right.
And the idea is, if you're doing something, let's say you're making your own short or you're doing your own student film, and you need help to get somewhere, you need a mentor to be able to show you what to do. You connect with a mentor through his program, and that person will go to a little live session with you on your computer, on your desktop, be able to control your desktop to show you how to do things. You'll have webcams, you'll have connections, and you get this whole package. It sounds really cool.
It's a great idea.
Brilliant.
It's a really good idea. And what it's also going to do is, in order to incentivize people to go check it out, et cetera, you can go to their website. And I think there'll be more details on there, but he's going to do a giveaway where you can do a live or a free demo reel review of your stuff. So you submit your demo reel and a mentor will be able to review it with you and tell you how to make it work.
Yeah, which is great.
Yeah.
A lot of people need that sort of feedback.
Yeah, exactly. So that's cool. I didn't know you were going to be part of the live mentor
stuff. Yeah, he gave me a call a little while ago. I was in the parking lot of a Home Depot.
Nice.
When he called, it's like 115 degrees outside. I'm like, I got to talk to Throb about his website. And nothing sexual about it.
Yeah.
So I was immediately turned off. But then he talked about what it was. And I'm like, oh, this sounds really actually great.
Yeah, cool. Very good. All right, guys. Hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
This podcast is going to be your most useless podcast ever.
That's what everyone always says. They always think it's going to be really bad and ends up being pretty darn good. But so I guess we should let people know about the fact that we've known each other for a pretty long time.
Yeah, I think I may have had some hair, when you first met me.
You did have hair.
Yeah.
And I had more hair.
Well, that's true.
I had a lot more hair.
Yeah. And I don't blame, I don't blame my genes for that. I blame visual effects for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I had hair before I started visual effects.
That's right.
It faded fast.
Yeah, I don't know how Vlado has and Peter have good heads of hair. They've been doing this for a long time.
It's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Vlado's got a good set of hair.
He has a great head of hair, that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very frustrating for me.
Very, very frustrating. Even Daniel's losing his hair a little bit.
Oh, man.
He's probably going to hear this, but yeah.
But, so I remembered something today because I was coming over here. I was like, oh, wait a minute. And so you actually got me into V-Ray, right?
I think.
You are the cause of a lot of these problems that I've had.
Well, I think what happened was it was on Day After Tomorrow, and they were working on this amine occlusion pipeline.
Oh, yeah.
It was taking like 6 or 9 months to develop this pipeline.
Oh, it was, I remember.
And I was sitting there going, why? Have they ever heard of ray tracing before?
Right.
And I was just really frustrated. And everyone's like, Chris, you don't understand. This is the pipeline. This is process. This is what it takes to make a major feature film. And this is what you have to do. And you have to use it, the system. And I sort of looked at you, and you were the only person who goes, you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, oh, it's all BS. You know, it's like, this doesn't have to be this way. And I showed you what I could do in V-Ray.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah. And then you ran with it. So what did you do with it, actually?
So what happened is, at the time, I was playing around, crazily enough, with Arnold.
Right.
Way back. Like, it was in the, for anybody who has any CG history, then Marnie was the glue, right? So Marcos and the guys had written Marnie, which was Maya to Arnold.
Maya to Arnold. But before that, actually, Arnold was a Max renderer.
Arnold was a Max renderer. And so Marcos had rewritten it because he was doing... And of course, we're talking about Arnold in a V-Ray podcast, which is wacky, but the history is fun. So yeah, Marcos had rewritten it because he was working for, and I can't remember the name of the company, but he rebuilt Arnold to be a volumetric lighting tool for stage design. And I remember he sent me some stuff. I mean, we're talking a long time ago.
Okay.
And that stuff was rad.
My first experience with Arnold, and this, I got to say, this is around the time where I started realizing that type of rendering was possible. And this is before I even knew V-Ray, to be honest. It was Pepe Land.
Oh, the Pepe Land days.
Yeah.
Daniel Perez?
I think so, yeah. And it was that little awesome soldier, and it was like, oh my God, it looks like a mannequin. It looks like an amazing thing. And then it started to move, and it was like, oh yeah. The idea of what they did was really cool. And it was like that. And then everyone went for that look, which is basically the ambient occlusion look, right?
Yeah.
But that was where it was. And they had a focus that was going on. And
well, that was the nice thing about, you know, when Arnold came on the scene, and even, and especially like what V-Ray does, like when I made a switch, because I'm like an old, I mean, I started in the business as like doing Lightwave stuff, right?
Right.
And Lightwave at the time, for a long time, was the renderer du jour because it could handle so much different stuff. And it took a lot of... it took a lot of time for me to choose another renderer besides Lightwave. Like I would take all my Maya stuff right into Lightwave. I'd take anything right into Lightwave because I could control it really well. Mm-hmm. I could get the shaders to do what I wanted. But more importantly, each renderer has its own look. And, you know, Maxwell has its own look. Arnold has its own look. V-Ray, they all have their own look. And when I played with V-Ray, I realized that it was in some ways weirdly aesthetically, and there's no rhyme or reason to it, but aesthetically for me, it was more pleasing than Lightwave. And I liked what it did. But more importantly, what I really liked is that it didn't have a specular control.
Right.
It was reflection.
Reflection is specular.
Exactly.
And nowadays that seems normal. But back then it was like, no, what do you mean? Specular and reflection are two different things. And no one understood that there was that they were actually the same thing.
Right. Yeah, and it took my brain just a little bit to retrain on that because, you know, you're looking at, you know, 7 or 8, 10, 15 years of not having to do that. But, you know, because it was all hacks, right? The specular is essentially a hack.
It's a fake reflection.
Yeah, exactly. And so when I messed with V-Ray and it had no specular and I was, you know, messaging Vlado on, I think it was ICQ at the time or something. Right. Like, hey, where's the specular control? And he goes, oh, it's reflection. And as I started to wrap my head around that, I realized the brilliant simplicity.
Right.
And so one day when he brought specular back in due to user demands, I was like, no, take it out.
Right.
Take it out. This is superior.
Right.
You just have to educate people and just educate them and they'll be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, the specular, of course, made it back in and it's fine. But I never use it.
And then when I see people use it, I'm going, oh.
You can tell immediately.
You can tell.
Because something looks wrong.
Right.
Yep. Just like when people don't turn Fresnel on.
Yes.
Oh, that angers me.
Now it's on by default. Finally. Finally, Fresnel is on by default.
It should turn it on even after you turn it off.
Turn it off and you say, are you sure? Yes. And it still turns it back on.
It should just be a fake checkbox. And it should do nothing and always just be on.
Yep. That would be good.
That would be ridiculous. Oh man, the emails they would get would be.
I actually sometimes, and I'll tell you why. Sometimes I turn it off to enable it in a mix map of some kind.
Oh, yeah. Okay, sure.
So there's sometimes a reason that you want to do all your reflections as a 100% reflection and then mix it back in a unified for now.
Sure.
So there are some ways that you may want to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, people have always used like the
but there should always be a for now there. If you turn it off.
There needs to be a reflection fall off of some kind. Mm-hmm. However you do it is kind of on you as the artist. That's the art part of it. But right. it definitely has to be there. There's no question.
But you were also one of the first people to bring V-Ray to Digital Domain and the first project they ever ran there. You were the first one to tell Eric Barba about it.
Yeah, in fact, I had lunch with Eric today, funnily enough, as a
very cool. So tell us the story. How did you go to Eric and show up? Because I've heard this story, but it'd be cool to come first.
So let's see what salient points I can come out of it. So initially, when we were testing V-Ray at DD, we tested it on Stealth. That was the first real test at Digital Domain.
Right. We should note that Stealth was not rendered in V-Ray. But
right,
it was,
yes. Stealth was definitely not rendered in V-Ray. But we did a test of RenderMan versus V-Ray versus Brazil versus Lightwave.
Yeah. And it was done.
And I was the guy.
And they made a Skunkworks group.
It was total Skunkworks. Yeah. Right. You're 100% right. And I remember we were all looking at the jet that we were rendering. And I remember, you know, thinking it's a jet. It's so easy. You know, we couldn't be given a more easy task to render. It's a jet.
Yes.
You know, we'd always, myself and some of the other guys were like, it's a jet. Why is this so hard? And at some point, somebody saw something by Rune Spons, and I'm sure, Rune, if you're listening to this, I'm mispronouncing your name, and I apologize. But I remember that Eric Hansen and I, Eric was one of the CG leads on Fifth Element, super talented guy, great dude.
Yeah, he's been on this podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Eric and I call this guy on the phone, and I believe he's in Norway.
Yes.
And so we call this Norwegian guy on the phone and we're like, hey, so this is, you know, Eric Hansen and Rob Niederhorst from DD. And he goes, hello? Yeah. He's not expecting a phone call from two guys from Digital Domain.
Right.
And so we asked him how he did. And he's like, I don't know. It was pretty easy. I just hit the buttons and we're like, holy crap. You know, how
and I think he actually did it in Brazil.
He did that. He did that in Brazil. But right. that was the impetus for us to try different renderers out. You know,
right.
And so.
Because let's just. Call it what it was. We've been working on a jet for a long time.
Yeah.
With RenderMan, it wasn't looking photoreal.
It wasn't getting there.
And then when you looked at someone on a forum, on a Brazil forum, basically made this jet look way better than anything that DD had come up with at that point. It was a little bit like,
yeah.
Oh shit, we got to get our
And it took him no time and it's one dude.
Right, exactly.
How can one guy outwit brilliant minds that we worked with? Because yep. The guys who were working on it were absolutely awesome.
Yeah.
You know, Estrus and his team are super brilliant dudes. Yeah. You know, a lot of respect for those guys. And I remember he's like, I was pretty easy. I did it like a month. And we're like, you know, head slapping each other. Like, how are we doing this? And that's when we started testing out the different renderers. And so it was on me to test out the 3ds Max based renderers. And one of those renderers obviously being V-Ray. Ultimately for me, V-Ray beat out Brazil for a variety of reasons. And so, you know, we did a test and it came out looking pretty good and it kind of sold the idea of that DD could do this jet for the show.
Right.
And then we reverse engineered all that into the RenderMan pipeline on how we can make that work.
Right. Because I think the biggest drawback was at that time was that they didn't know if they could find enough people to use Max to do a whole feature film at that time.
Yeah. They were extremely concerned about the artist workflow.
Right.
I didn't see the challenge, but I, you know, hey, you just get
that's fine.
Let's push the button.
So they would rather reverse engineer it than to actually.
Yeah. And so they made that decision. It's totally fine. And so one day I remember I was, so Eric Barba, I've known Eric for a long, he is my contact that got me into Domain way back in the late 90s. Yep. And so I remember because I used to sit next to Eric and I've known him, you know, like I said, for a long time. So he was testing out this thing for a music video for Nine Inch Nails.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of depth of field, a lot of, it had to physically match some photography they were doing. And so I was like, hey, dude, you should come. Can you hand me one of those scenes? Let me just fiddle around with it. So I fiddled around with it. And I was like, you got to come check this out. I got to show you this cool renderer that I'm messing with. It's called V-Ray. And he's like, I don't know what it is. I'm like, just get over to my desk. So he walks over. And I'm showing him tricks like irradiance caching and stuff like that. Stuff that a guy like Eric Barba would totally get because he's like an old school lighting dude.
Yep.
And so I remember he like called somebody. He's like, yeah, nobody calls me for the next hour. And he sat down. And he's like, show me everything. Mm-hmm. And so I walked him through as much as I knew at the time of V-Ray. And I was like, this is how this works. This is how this works. And ultimately, he was the one who made the decision to do all of the Nine Inch Nails video in V-Ray. And I want to say that that was a pretty, like, pretty major turning point for Digital Domain in terms of rendering. Because it started kind of a, started the wheels of change.
And it was about physical lighting.
Absolutely.
And about using real depth of field, 3D depth of field, motion blur, everything was done in camera.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And it was a pretty ambitious and pretty hardcore, even for V-Ray at the time, to do that. And it was sort of the first thing like, oh my God, how did you do that?
Yeah, we pushed V-Ray really, really hard. And great, I mean, we pushed the pipeline and the workflow at DD really hard because they, you know, we had to have Windows machines because at the time the farm was mostly Linux boxes. So they had to switch the farm over to Windows. And I remember being on the phone with Autodesk trying to get 3ds Max to render network-based 3ds Max scenes, which it didn't do at the time.
Right.
I still think there's a problem with that, but whatever. Sure.
Because we had it only worked with its own render queue system, which was Backburner or something like that, which DD was not going
to
use.
Yeah, and so we did get it to work in a command line. They had a command line version, but it would never, if you had a file that was on the network, it would drop textures randomly.
Right.
It was a total mess. And so ultimately, I remember calling one of the guys at Autodesk and I hear this, hello? And I'm like, whoa, what's going on? And he's like, he's on his bike, like heading into work. And I'm like, hey, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to call you while you were, you know, calling into work.
Right.
But I spent like an hour and a half on the phone with this guy, Claude Robillard, I believe is his name.
Wow.
Claude was really, really nice guy and was like, oh, you know what you should try? Copy the scene local and see what happens. And I was like, okay, well, that's easy. So edit the Perl script, boom, copy the scene local. All problems disappear immediately. I'm like, oh, okay, let's try it on 200 machines. Brr, turn it up. All works. No problem. I'm like, okay, well, this is enough. This is enough of a test for me. Let's do this. And so that's like, that really got the ball rolling. But I mean, the render times were, we had extreme render times on that show. I mean, we're talking, this is an old version of V-Ray where the optimizations that, you know, the entire development team.
Oh, yeah, this is before in like 1.2 or something like that.
Oh, yeah, this is really early on.
And the hardware was, the computers we're using were way
slow as hell.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, we're talking 14 to 20 hour render times per frame.
Right.
But that's with everything turned on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was nothing that wasn't on.
Right.
We hit all the buttons and just said go.
Right.
Let the computers burn while the artists work on the other shots.
Right.
Yep. And it was, you know, unfortunately, I wasn't there to finish the show, but it looked awesome when it was done.
I wonder what it would be like to render that today with a new version of V-Ray on that same resolution, probably render in like 5 minutes.
Yeah, you could probably get it at least, even at super high quality, probably under half an hour.
I bet you could even do faster than that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny because we were just doing comparisons of V-Ray 1.7, so the one before you had to upgrade V-Ray, right? So the last version of the one version.
Sure.
And V-Ray 3.0. And the 1.7 renders, like we did a test scene, it took it to do this specific scene. It took 8.5 minutes to render the scene. And then we rendered exact same thing in 3.0 with nothing changed. And it rendered it in 1:18. Eight times faster. Same hardware, same settings, same everything.
Amazing.
Yeah. So it's significantly faster. So
8 times. So that is... let's say that's about 10 years or a little less.
Yep.
A little less 10 years. It's an
Eight times speed up. And that's on the same hardware. Now, if you take the 14 hour renders on that old hardware and then you take that another X amount, I bet you can do it in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
I really get, anyway, that aside,
awesome.
You moved to Vera and then you disappeared. You started doing some other stuff after you got out of DD right after Nine Inch Nails, right?
Yeah. So Nine Inch Nails was my last show over there. And then I went over to Sway and we worked my first big project we worked on there. So the guy who ran Sway is also an ex-Lightwave guy, funnily enough.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Glazer, super good dude, great eye. To the point of pain for all of his employees.
Yes.
He's a super talented guy.
I've worked at Sway too.
So yeah, no, I know.
Can acknowledge that.
That's why you and I can share the love there.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, I said, hey, Mark, you got to check out this renderer. And he was a big Lightwave guy. And as soon as I showed it to him and what it could do and how, you know, it bettered Lightwave in a few different ways, especially with how physically based it was, you know, way even back then, he said, wow, this is awesome. Let's do a little test. So we did a little test, came out really good. He goes, okay, well, let's get some seats. Let's see if we can get some 3DS Max seats in here. Let's try it out. And the first thing we really tried it out on was a project with a director that at the time, very few people had heard of, Joe Kaczynski.
Right.
Who now a few people have heard of.
Yeah.
He's in a couple of movies. And I remember Joe and I like sat and like he came over and we did previs together. It was great.
Right.
Joe, you know, one of really super collaborative guy, as you know, because you've worked with him as well.
And this was his first. Now, Joe had been, you know, doing ArcViz and other interesting things at the time. And he got picked up by Anonymous and he was going to be a director.
Yeah.
But this was his first commercial.
This was his first big, big commercial that I think really paid him.
Right. Right.
And it was for Clove cigarettes.
Yes.
So I'm going to hell for advertising cigarettes.
But what's strange about it? What country was this in?
Singapore.
Singapore. So yeah. A Singapore commercial for Clove cigarettes. You see the commercial. There's not a cigarette inside. It makes no sense at all.
No.
These are very athletic people.
I want to say that there was some, and you know, I know somebody from Singapore is going to correct me on this, but I think there was some kind of restriction. You couldn't actually show anybody smoking in cigarette commercials in Singapore.
But you could still do a commercial about cigarettes.
You could do a commercial about the brand.
Right.
But that was it.
Okay.
And so we did a commercial about the brand.
Which Jarum was about healthy, Mezzo. Wonderful people jumping around.
They were all beautiful and yes. They all ran around and did awesome stuff on this crazy like ethereal plane.
And what was amazing about that thing is that basically the whole thing, all the actors were shot completely green screen and the entire environment was done in CG.
Yeah. It was kind of crazy. I mean, what were we thinking? We did all that stuff CG. It was extremely challenging.
Right.
This was back in 2005, I want to say. So 10 okay. years ago. It was extremely challenging. We ran into all kinds of problems, and really the least of our concerns was actually the rendering. That was nothing. You know, once we worked it all out and we just irradiance cached everything because it was all architecture.
Yeah, you can just bake it out, right?
So we used all the architecture tricks.
Right.
And the renders were, I don't even want to remember. They were cheap. They were, you know, 15 to 20 minutes a frame.
Right.
At the time, we were rendering a 720 by 405 because it was a standard definition yep. thing. So we never did the full res that we do now HD. And the compositing was absolutely brutal because the people wearing white in an all green world. And so they basically were
lime green white.
Yeah. They were wearing basically green clothes by the time that we got the plates. What we did is we shot film, actual film. And then
I didn't know it was shot on film.
Yeah. We shot it on film because we had to shoot at, we did it at 120.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the shots of people jumping over the
slow
camera
motion, right.
were shot at 120 frames a second so we could really slow it down. And then Joe wanted to slow it down double of that to go to 240.
Right.
And we did some of that in post on in the DI side of things that we did. And we came up with a crazy way to take the green out of the clothes, which was to desaturate by painting. So there was a guy there who, instead of rotoing, ended up painting the clothes white. So desaturated all the white stuff.
Wow. And
it ended up being way better than the roto, right? Because the roto, you're going to get errors because humans do it.
Right.
But if you paint out the saturation, now you've made a perfectly keyable thing.
Right.
And so when we did it at 2K, we then pulled the key at 2K, resed everything down. So if there are any kind of small edge problems, we reduce them completely
mm-hmm.
by resing down. So you're going to, you know, almost a quarter of the res.
Right.
So we got rid of a lot of our little, like the edging issues that if you were looked at them in 2K, now you'd be like, yeah, it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
It totally worked for us because we were going to, you know, less than half resolution.
Right.
It was a huge, you know, everybody was like, you're crazy. Why are you scanning it? Just go through the telescene. I'm like, nope, I'm not doing any of that. I'm doing it my way. This is my job. Give me.
That's the way you've always operated that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Much to the chagrin of almost everybody that I've ever worked for.
Yeah.
Yep. Yes. That was a great spot. And, you know, Sway, then I kind of, you know, we kind of switched over completely to V-Ray after that.
Right.
Because it was such a huge win in terms of quality, but also, you know, speed and cost and actually artist time spent fiddling with stuff dropped like crazy
mm-hmm.
because it was more about physically based stuff.
Sure.
And so you could remove, and this sounds ridiculous, but you could reduce artist noodling on what the artist thinks it should be when you just get the accurate numbers,
sure,
essentially, and that just makes your life easy. And that's what I want. For me, the art is the lighting.
Right.
You know?
Well, besides using V-Ray, which of course is good news for us, but you did another really amazing thing at that time to help Sway, and that's to hire Daniel Buck. I think that was one of the first things that that you guys did, and you brought him into the fold of lighting in this world, which I think to me is, you know,
an amazing thing. Daniel Buck is super talented.
Yeah.
That guy's awesome.
And he just came out, he was a student. You guys, were you involved in hiring him or?
Yeah. Mark Glazer kind of found him, and then we kind of brought him in all together. Like, yeah, let's try this guy out.
And he just drove out here from Arizona.
He just drove out here from Arizona with his car, and he's like, I'm doing this.
Right.
And then, you know, that's how you do it. You give yourself no option to go back.
Right.
You only go forward.
Yeah. So yeah, that was pretty cool. And at that time, while you were doing that, I was over at Sony, very bored. Very bored, but I had a generally good job. It was a really good job at Sony, and they were really great, but it was not necessarily very challenging on the lighter side of things. So I remember I had spoken to Kevin Mack at the time, who was my supervisor the guy who turns on fire.
Oh, Ghost Rider.
Ghost Rider, yes, yeah. Thank you. I don't even remember. I never even saw the movie, by the way. But I was on Ghost Rider with Kevin Mack, who was an awesome VFX supervisor. And I was just getting frustrated with, I got to do more than just be a lighter in a cubicle right now. And I asked him out to lunch. I was like, I'll buy you lunch if I do that. Have second of your time. I know you're a VFX supervisor. You're very busy. And he took me out to lunch. Or I took him out to lunch and he had time to do it. And I said, you know, I want to get into next level. What are the things I have to do to be a CG supervisor? Actually, I'm not interested in being a CG. I really want to be a VFX supervisor. What are the steps I need to take to be a VFX supervisor? Because everyone's telling me, well, the steps are you do a good job at this, and then you become a lead, and then after that you become a CG supervisor, and then you have time to become a VFX supervisor. So I don't have time for that shit. Because that's a 10-year path of just, well, I did my dues and I did that. I just didn't want to do that. It's like, there's got to be more. I think I want to sit here just waiting for my opportunity. And what he suggested, and it was funny, he said, well, technically, you know, if you stay at Sony, those are the kind of things you do. Or, you didn't hear this from me, but you could go to places that are not Sony, that are smaller, that basically can give you the opportunity as long as someone knows that that's going to happen.
Right.
And it was around that time where I literally, like a week or two after I had that lunch, you called me.
Right.
And you're like, I've got this idea. I want to start something, and we should talk. And we went out, and then that's when you basically said, I want to start this other, you know, this branch company from over here, and I'd like you to be a part of it. And that's when it was you, me, and Greg Tzatzilis.
Right. Over at SpeedShape.
SpeedShape.
I remember when they called me. And I went over there and I met with the executive producer for the first time. We walked into the office that we'd never seen before. Mm-hmm. There weren't any chairs in there. We're like, well, it's going to be difficult to work without chairs.
Right.
Where's the computers? Oh, yeah, we don't have any of those either. All right, we got to figure that out.
Yeah, I walked in and was like, oh, we got a clean slate here. We got to do whatever we want to do.
I don't think there's ever a place where the slate was cleaner than that.
No. It was so clean that we like got all the computers and figured out, oh, we don't have enough power.
Yeah.
And then after we figured that problem out, oh, everything's overheating. We need to get better AC. Every step of the way, we're like, oh, okay, this is how it takes to.
Do you remember the crazy render rack that we had, the sound dampening render rack?
Yes.
So I have that at my house right now.
Oh, you do? You still have it?
Nice. I love that thing. That thing is amazing. I remember
the thing, it was so loud. We were using AMD processors at the time.
Yes. Yeah.
And
dual quad core?
Yeah, AMDs? Optrons.
Or dual cores, yeah, the Opterons, yeah.
Opterons, and they were very powerful at the time. More powerful, we made a decision, it was, you know, it's typical Rob Niederhorst, I'm going with the latest!
Yeah.
And we were like, they were faster than the Intels at the time, and so like, we're going with Opterons, and we were like, wah! They were so loud, and we had a rack of these computers, and we put them in this rack, and you're like, wah! Click. Then you close the door, and it was closed, and it was like amazing. Yeah.
The only problem with that, though, is at the bottom of the rack, the temperature would be like Fahrenheit, maybe like 65.
Yeah.
At the top of the rack, it'd be 115.
Right. It did not cool efficiently. Or it could have been the blades themselves or whatever.
The whole thing was, it was a 25U rack.
Right.
And we filled the entire thing top to bottom. There wasn't one U slot of space because we put the network switch, the file server.
Everything.
We put everything in that thing. Yeah. It was literally, because it had wheels, it was like a portable visual effects unit that you could never carry anywhere because it was way too heavy.
Right.
That was crazy. I remember when we worked on that Northrop Grumman job.
Yep.
Which I referenced just the other day as like another weird,
interesting
coincidence.
You know what? Funny about that job, Steve Reese, who was the executive producer, he sent, I think you were on that email, he sent an email about an animation that looked very much like that Northrop Grumman thing that did. And he's like, does this look familiar?
Oh, yeah. I remember that. I remember even like about 2 or 3 years after, maybe even more after we did the Jarom Mezzo stuff at Sway, somebody basically ripped off the whole thing and made a clone of it and just did a terrible job. Like if you're going to steal something, you got to do it better.
Yeah.
You can't schlock through it.
No.
If you're going to rip it off, you got to crush the next version.
Right. Exactly.
You know, at least go, if you're going to do that, just do it well.
Yep.
Yeah. I remember that. But I remember seeing that copy that Steve sent me. That was really funny. And I remember that we had this crazy portable cooler that we hooked into the bottom of the unit, and it would blow 30 degree air Fahrenheit, so really cold air, into the bottom of the unit. So then the bottom of the unit was like 40 degrees, and the top of the unit was like 90 degrees.
So it was better than 150.
It was better, but still brutal.
Yes.
It was, I mean, you could, I remember we glued one of those paper thermometers on the inside to detect the temperature change.
Yes. Nowadays, we'd use like an infrared thermometer.
But. Yeah, exactly. Which is one of those little guns or whatever. Yeah. Like, boop, what's going on? Oh, yeah, that was good. Oh, yeah, Speech Ape. And they did a lot of great. I mean, they were at the time, they were probably, I'll go out on a limb and say, the best car visualizers in the world.
Well, they had sort of pioneered their own way of taking CAD data and then transforming it into usable, renderable data.
Yeah, they did a great job at
and
that.
And there was some struggles that we dealt with, which is expected, where suddenly like the data was too big. You know, nowadays like I can render whatever you throw at me.
Yeah.
But back then it was like you can't. We only had 2 gigs of RAM, and like we were still on a 32-bit operating system.
Oh yeah, I remember.
So you know, it's like you can't hand me the valve the valve on the cap of the tire, like
with the
fully
threads.
Embossed with the threads and the words "turn here" modeled in. It's like, it can't happen that way. It's like,
there was like 100,000 polygons or something ridiculous like that for the little cap.
So it was a challenge, but it got really, really good. And I met a lot of really interesting people at the time. And, you know, one of the ones that I remember very specifically, was Justin.
Yeah,
who
sure.
I think was, in my mind, one of the most underrated people there because they're like, oh, he's the seat guy. But he wasn't just a seat guy.
He's a good modeler.
He actually modeled the crap out of those seats, and he did it in ZBrush. Back then, it was like ZBrush was still kind of new.
Yeah.
And he made all the threads perfectly, the creases. Those seats look beautiful.
Yeah, they crushed those things. They had a really good team of people that would do that.
Yeah.
And they had that stuff nailed down.
Yeah.
Really, really good process.
Yeah.
I remember.
And you headed up basically SpeechShift for quite a while. You were doing a bunch of really interesting projects there.
Yeah. I was there from, 2006 or was it 2005? I think it was 2005 maybe to 2009, right at the end of 2009. So I was there 4.5, ish years, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We did some cool stuff. Worked with Kaczynski again on a Saab commercial, all spec. And that won an award at something called the D Show.
Right.
That was kind of cool. Yeah, that was a really nice spot. That spot was, once again, super brutal in true, Niederhorst Kaczynski style, murder everybody on the show. But we did, because I remember at one point, we were looking at the I'll call it the footage, but it was all CG. We're looking at the all CG shots, and it just didn't work. And I was starting to hate everything. And so I started looking for new reference. We had about 2 weeks left.
Mm-hmm.
I started looking for new reference because the reference we were using too much reference. That was a problem. It was noise.
We wanted to look like this. We wanted to look like this. We wanted to look like this.
And it was too much.
Nothing
solid.
I was
like, I'm gonna Google until I reach the end of Google and I find the image that I want that encapsulates what I want.
You would
to
probably
see.
Find a script that could search all of Google and give you what you wanted. Better than Google could.
I actually sort of did that for something else in a, like a weird, yeah. For, yeah, for anti-piracy efforts.
Right.
Yeah, in a weird way. Yeah, and I found the image and I showed it to my buddy Mark Rienzo, who was working with me at the time, amazing compositor guy. And I said, look, what do you think? He goes, oh, that looks pretty good. I go, this is going to be a lot of work, dude. He goes, yeah, well, you got to do this. And I go, well, if you're ready, I'm ready. Let's send it to Joe. Send it over to Joe. And Joe's like, I love it. And we're like, okay, here we go.
Yeah, and basically you redid the commercial.
We redid almost the entire thing.
Right.
Not from scratch because we had everything built. We redid a lot of the lighting, a lot of the look, all the comp mm-hmm. was completely redone. It was all comp by Mark and I, and we just went through and went nuts on that thing. And it ended up, that was a good decision to do.
Yep.
But
and
it was,
you got to do those things.
It was brutal. I mean, we were at work till 5 o'clock in the morning for probably 2 weeks straight.
Right.
I mean, the great part about it is traffic. Traffic in Los Angeles is really good from about 3 to 4:30 a.m.
Yes.
You can get anywhere within about 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Because you can go about 100 miles an hour.
Yep.
Which you shouldn't do if you haven't slept for about 15 hours.
Agreed.
But, you know, that's the dumb stuff you do.
Yeah. The advantage of working in visual effects in Los Angeles is generally you work late enough that you don't have to deal with traffic on
you
the
avoid,
way home.
You avoid. It's ridiculous.
You can avoid traffic on the way home.
Yeah.
More than most people. So you only deal with one traffic, usually in the morning.
Right.
But evening traffic you don't deal with because you're usually going home at like 10 or 11 or midnight.
And the awesome part is there's so many good podcasts out now that I go through podcasts like crazy.
Like mine.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're on my list.
Nice. Nice. Well, cool. Cool. And we should actually note, speaking of podcasts, that you actually approached me about being on this podcast. You were like, I want to be on the podcast.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's awesome to be part of the Chaos Group stuff.
Absolutely. And always. You were absolutely on my list. So I'm glad you called because I'm like, at some point I was going to call you. So I was like, oh great. He's called me. So I don't have to deal with calling him.
Yeah.
But you've had some things that you wanted to talk about a little bit.
Yeah. So I wanted to come on here because I've been teaching for a while at USC, which is University of Southern California here in Los Angeles. And
how long have you been teaching there?
I've been teaching there for 4 years.
Okay.
So I do one semester each time,
yep.
And I do a lot of compositing and VFX training and stuff over there. And I've also, you know, I've done the Gnomon DVDs and things like that. And it's all been really cool.
Yeah, and you were doing the Nuke DVDs, which were the first Nuke DVDs.
They yeah.
Did. At the same time, I did the first V-Ray DVDs. So
yes,
you and I were,
I remember
we
that.
Were both at Speed Shape and we're like, all right, how many did you sell? How many did you sell?
And mine, I sold like 4. I sold so little because mine were too early. I came out with mine about 2 years too early.
2 years too early. That makes sense because there wasn't enough people that had access to Nuke at the time.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, now you've got people doing all kinds of stuff there.
Yep.
And so what I started to notice is when I started training people is there was a wide gap where if you make a course, and I've done this and so have you, when you build the course, you build it for success. So if you show somebody, do this, push here, do that, you end up with a high quality result because you haven't set it up to fail. You've set it up to succeed, which is awesome.
Right.
Except failure is where you learn in a weird way. Right. And so by not understanding, by being able to take a problem and dissect it to its components, that's how you can really start to learn how to solve problems overall. And so I started to realize that the standard online training is not enough for visual effects. And the reason is visual effects is so complicated and there's so many moving parts to it that it is very challenging to learn the craft of making beautiful images. It's not that it's not learnable. It absolutely is.
Sure.
But it's not easy. And it takes an absolutely huge amount of time. And as I've gotten older and as I've listened to a lot of podcasts about things like minimum effective dose and the Pareto principle and things is I started to realize I'm able to break down what it takes to do something in a pretty good way. And so I started to apply that unbeknownst to my students,
Okay.
So the second class that I have at USC, I go over a Nuke script, which touches about 80% of what you would ever need in a comp.
Okay.
And then the next script is like the rest of it.
Okay.
And so at the very end of those two lessons, I'm like, okay, you now know over 80% of what you ever need to do a comp.
Right.
If you never look at any other scripts for the rest of the semester, you have this information and nobody gets it. And so what I'm starting to do and what I'm a new business I'm working on is something called Live Mentor. And my goal is to change the face of education, but I'm going to start small with our niche industry that we all love, and this visual effects industry. Mm-hmm. And so what it's going to be, it is a live mentoring service where you as the user can connect with an industry professional such as myself or you, whomever is on the platform as a mentor, mm-hmm. and you get an hour of time with that person per month. They do a full screen share. It's video conferencing. It is text, you know, chat, everything like mm-hmm. that. What's awesome about the screen sharing is you can annotate the screen, which is super cool, mm-hmm. and you can request remote control of the user's computer. So if the user's here like, hey, can you show me some, you know, I'll use something obviously, you know, worthwhile here in V-Ray, like, hey, I'm doing this V-Ray thing. Can you optimize a couple of things or something that's taking a long time? Can you explain how the optimization process works for sure. X? And you can go, yes, I can. Give me control of your screen. Boom, control the screen, work out and go, okay, see this, explain this here and go boom, 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 and explain the reason why you're doing it. And where they learn is because it's on their system, right? It's
they're learning where they might have made a mistake.
Yeah, and it's on their project.
Right.
So something that they've been running into as a blockage.
So it's almost like they're creating their own curriculum and you're just stepping in.
You're stepping in as a little bit of, you know, I see it as you know how to climb, you know, up the side of a cliff, let's say.
Okay.
I help provide the boost.
Sure.
So I give you the boost every once in a while when you need it. And that allows you to grip your hands just that little bit higher to reach the top. I don't want to put you at the top of the mountain because that you don't learn that way.
Right.
But I want to every once in a while, if you slip, I want to be there and put my hand up and hold your foot so you don't fall.
Right.
Right. And so that's the goal of Live Mentor. And so I've been doing this with a couple of my students, and the amount of time they save, if somebody, you know, and in fact, I did this with you, like I would ask you questions. This is essentially... is if you or I were in the same room working mm-hmm. with each other,
yep.
hey, can you look at this thing? Yeah, sure. You show me something.
Right.
And all of a sudden, I've saved myself 5 hours of Googling.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's essentially what happens. And so when I've talked to students who have taken this service, they're like, I go, how much time did I save? They're like, oh yeah. They're like, some of this I never would have been able to find out by Googling
right.
because you know Nuke so well or whatever it is. And some of it, yeah, I would have had to take 5 digital tutors lessons and this other thing over here and this, and it's all
disparate. And I would have had to derive from what I just learned how to actually fix what I need to do. No one's actually looking at it in context.
Exactly. And yeah. So it's essentially tutoring, but the plan, it's more of, I want it to be a mentoring service because, you know, if you go to the gym and you don't have somebody to go with, you end up stop going to the gym.
Sure.
It happens.
Yeah, it's like having a trainer.
And that's essentially what the service is. Right. You know, I want to help people that way.
Right.
And, you know, visual effects is it's a cool job, man. I like it.
Yeah.
The work is awesome, but it's so challenging to get good at it. And I want to help other people get good at it and to help make their art as good as it can be.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, it's interesting because it is a two-way street though, because, the only way that students are going to take advantage of that is if they take advantage of that.
Yeah.
And I think some of the best, I don't want to say students, but some of the best people that I've worked with, junior people that are there, that are learning, that we hire. And I love working with young people that have never, like, it's their first job.
Oh, yeah.
Because one is so rewarding to see them learn mm-hmm. and see them grow and see their, like, eyes go. They get excited about it.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I've been bored about this for so long. And right. to see someone excited, it's like, oh, I remember that.
Yeah,
that,
yeah.
It was fun to be excited about that.
Yeah.
So it is always a great thing, but it's also that two-way street where some of the people are too proud to ask the questions. Some of them are too scared to ask the questions. They don't want to look like an idiot. And, you know, there's no such thing as a stupid question. There's only stupid answers, right?
Right.
And so you really have to sort of look at that as saying, it's your opportunity. And I like the fact that it's like, they're going to pay for you to be there. So they better ask you questions because they're paying for it, right? Or whatever they're doing. Or it's that was the mentality I used at school when I was in. It wasn't until I was in grad school that I realized, like, oh shit, the teachers. I'm not trying to please their teachers. The teachers, they work for me.
Right.
Their job is to teach me. So it's my job to get as much out of that person as possible.
Yeah.
And when you're doing an architecture project, it's not like, I hope my teacher likes it and I good grade. And they're like, no, I hope my teacher tears it apart so that I learn something from this process.
Right.
And that's the important part of it is, you know, not trying to prove that you're better than anyone else. Especially in education, the process is like, all right, I've got the battle scars. I know what I've done. And someone has helped me through that process, has healed the wounds and got it clicked up. And let's keep going because now, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So it's a really, really good idea. Yeah. I like it. It's really great.
Yeah. And I, you know, I've tested this with a few students and, you know, I there was one student who, a great guy, Brian Rhodes, he had a project. It's pretty ambitious to do a lot of CG characters here and there. And he's like, what do I do? And I said, and I gave him a bunch of advice. And so I finally got him kind of on the platform looking at stuff and I was scrubbing his edit real time in Premiere. Then we went in, you know, we went into his rendering things and I set some stuff up for him, helped him out. And then I explained why. And you know, I talked to him once a week, because you know that was the way we set it up. And I'm like, so how's it going? He's like, man. He goes, you have no idea how much further along I am. He goes, because you've answered all these questions for me. I didn't know how to do this stuff. He goes, and there's no training that gives me the exact answer I need for what I'm working on.
Right.
And I was like, I go, does that, you know? And I didn't know at the time, right? I'm experimenting.
Right.
I'm experimenting with, does this even work? And I said, so is this worth it? Like, are you really getting something out of it? He goes, oh. He goes, yeah. He goes, first of all, you saved me Googling time. That's awesome. He goes, but really the important part is my project's getting further along, but I'm learning because I know what stopped me from doing whatever the task was.
Sure.
You helped me push through that and I get why you did it because you explained it to me. And so all the videos are saved on our membership system. Mm-hmm. And so you get to review the video. There's an MP4, there's an MP3 of the audio, there's a text file, the whole thing. You get a zip file with all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, yeah. He goes, if I had any questions, I just go back to the zip file and I look at the video and I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah, that's what he said. He goes, if you go a little fast, that's okay because I can just go back and look at it and you walk through the whole process. He goes, man, it's awesome.
That's a really good idea. I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit because I think it's important. If you look at the way that you're structuring it and what the ideas, which I think is a very good, as I used to be a teacher as well, so I know exactly what you're going through. The issue is a lot of people say, I want to learn this, and they just basically expect to be spoon-fed information, and now I have this information, now I can do this, right? Sure. So what you're doing is you're throwing that away.
Yes.
And you're basically saying, you want to learn this? Just do it, and I'll be there to help you, which in a sense sounds like, I don't actually want to teach you anything, right? It sounds like, and it's not, I'm not saying it's a bad thing because I actually think it's a good thing because I think you learn more from this process. But it basically sounds like I'm actually going to do less as a teacher because I don't actually have to build a curriculum, show you everything, show you which buttons to do. But now you're doing it and I'll just be there to help you. And that is actually, sounds like a lazy way of doing it, but it is so much more valuable. I can't even tell you. I know exactly what you mean by that. Because if it's the same problem I've always had, everything I've had, if you're given a challenge, if I have to do a render, and that's the other thing about visual effects. Let's call that out.
Sure.
Visual effects, everything we do is something that's never been seen before.
That's always part of the brief.
It's something I've never seen before. So every time you do something in visual effects, you're going to have to figure it out on your own every time.
Right. Problem solving.
Problem solving. So what you're asking the students to do is like figure it out. They're going to have to do that for the rest of their career in visual effects.
Right.
So what I got out of grad school and what I got out of my entire education was not a degree that taught me how to be an architect, which I don't even use. What I got out of my education is I learned the tools to learn.
Right.
And I think that is an incredibly important thing for people to understand. It's like, learn how to learn something and you're going to do a better job at it in the end.
Yeah. I mean, my thing is learn the why, not the how.
Right. Oh,
Yeah.
There you go.
Because, you know, you or I, when we do a project, we make a decision for a certain reason. It's based on experience.
Right.
So if I can take a junior person and have them skip all the shitty parts of the stuff that will never work,
right,
and go, if you do X, it will work, and this is why it works, because this reason, try it the other way first.
Right.
And then try this other way that I just showed you, so you can understand
why
it doesn't work and why it does.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I did this with one of my students this last term, who was trying to shoot a genie that levitated, you know, and he was sitting in a standard yoga pose, and he wanted the genie to levitate. And he's like, I'm going to shoot it all on green screen. I was like, okay, don't have the genie sit on green. And he's like, but then I got it. I'm like, I go, is he moving his legs? And the student's like, no, he's just levitating. I'm like, okay, don't have him sit on green. Take his, from his midsection up and shoot that on green because he's moving his arms, right? Yeah, a little bit. Okay, fine. Do that. I go, then do me a favor, then shoot it on green and have him sit there and see what happens. And he goes, what? I go, just humor me. I go, just.
So you can see the difference.
So you can see the difference. And so he did. Unbelievably, he had time to do it. He did. And I go, let's look at the footage. So I looked at it. And of course, the footage where the guy is sitting on green, there's so much green spill on the genie's pants,
right,
that it would have been an absolute nightmare to key out. And then he would have had to roto the legs anyway.
Right. So you'd have to color correct it and still roto.
Yeah. And so my solution, just roto it.
Right.
He's not moving that much. You're going to have to roto anyway, because I know this, because I have done this before.
Right.
With Joe Kaczynski on that crazy mezzo job where he was wearing white and it was reflecting green.
Exactly.
So I was like, yep, I know the problem you're going to run into. Shoot it both ways. But now at least you're going to reduce your pain because you have a working solution. But you also have something that didn't work. And now you can visually see why. And he's like, man, he goes, I'm so glad you had me do that. He goes, because now I took your advice and I shot
and
the
he
way
did
you
it,
told me.
He did it on something that he was supposed to learn on as opposed to a very expensive commercial.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
Exactly.
But I mean, that, and it totally worked. He showed me the result and it was fine. It was cool. You know, he did his roto. And he's like, roto's annoying. I'm like, yeah, but you were
better than you would have done it anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I go, you would have had to do twice the work, including the roto. And now you just do it one time and you're done. And you keep the original colors of the pants, which was like that kind of shiny red with a little bit of gold and stuff. Oh, man.
Shiny on green.
Ooh. Yeah. Oh, no. It was destined for just like crying.
Right.
Somebody was going to cry. He was going to cry like a little girl who lost her binky. I mean, it was going to be, I knew it. I could smell it coming. Like, I've been there. I have cried like I lost my binky. There's no question.
Yeah.
Man. So yeah, that's cool. I mean, I'm just finishing up.
You know, how are you doing this? You're basically making a platform for this to happen?
Yeah. So I'm making the platform for this. We're using really good video conferencing software.
Mm-hmm.
So I found something that's much better than Skype. All the screen sharing, the annotation stuff, it all works really well.
And it saves it out for you.
It saves it out. So if you're the mentor, it saves it out to your local machine as an MP4. You zip all that stuff up, including the text file for the text chat. So if you want, like if you send somebody a website or if you send them some Python code or whatever, and it goes into a little text file, life is good. And if you wanted to listen to just the audio for whatever reason, let's say you just had a career session with your apprentice.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's like, oh, yeah, I did this. And, you know, you gave him some advice or whatever. Then you could listen to that MP3 and just have it on your phone and just listen to it. So there's a variety of ways to access the data. So that goes up onto our membership platform.
Okay.
And so that's for yours to download for as long as you want. You keep it, do whatever you want. You can share it. I don't care.
Right.
Share your stuff. It's your work.
So do you have a name for this?
Live Mentor.
Live Mentor.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it'll be live-mentor.com.
Okay. And do you have basically ideas of who would be your mentors and how you subscribe to this and how does it work?
Yeah. So it is a monthly fee.
Okay.
And I have several mentors in mind. And as soon as I'm doing a little bit of testing to gauge the interest.
Yep.
And once I see where the interest level is, so because it's my time and other people's time, there's a questionnaire. So in order to join up, you can't just sign up. You have to answer a questionnaire about, you know, what are you trying to learn? How much time do you have to dedicate to this, et cetera, et cetera.
But you also have to go into it actually knowing something.
Yeah. I mean, look, if this is a premium service.
Sure.
So if you're looking for you know, myself or another mentor to teach you what is a red channel, a green channel, or a blue channel, you're overpaying.
Right.
And I'm honest with you on that.
Right.
If you want me to do it, I mean, yes, I will, if you want me to get paid to do that.
Right.
But essentially, it's way overkill.
It's like hiring Michael, you know, Michael Jordan to tell you what a dribble is.
Exactly. Yeah.
Or what's traveling.
Exactly. Yeah. It may be a little bit way beyond of what's necessary.
Right.
But if you have a little bit of knowledge and you just want to, you know, I worked with a student who was at Full Sail just this weekend, mm-hmm. and she was, funnily enough, this is why I referenced a jet. She was having trouble making glint on a jet look right from the canopy.
Right.
And so I ended up messaging her. I'm like, hey, do you want to try something out that I'm starting to build about this mentoring service? She's like, oh, that's cool. And so I worked with her and I showed her what I would do with the lens flare node and how I use glares and things and stuff and just kind of my process on how to do it. Mm-hmm. So not just showing her where the buttons were, but why the buttons do what they do, mm-hmm. and how I would approach the solution to the problem. And she's like, wow, this is awesome. She's, man, you saved me hours of time.
Right.
She goes, and I get why you're doing it. And it's cool that you showed me this crazy trick. I'm like, yeah, this is my trick I do for everything.
Yeah.
You know, I don't mind showing people all my tricks. I don't care.
Yeah.
It's no big deal. There's no secret.
There is something to be said about live conversation.
Oh, without question. And it has to be, that's the beautiful thing. It's a webcam.
Yeah.
You know, so that you can see me, which is unfortunate for everybody out there. So you can see your mentor and you can actually have a conversation with that person.
Sure.
You know, I want there to be that personal connection. When I was doing the initial tests, I tried just audio and screen sharing and it was horrible.
Right.
It was super impersonal. And this was with a student that I'd worked with for several months already.
Right.
And then we tried out the audio only and I wanted to murder someone.
Okay.
It was so bad.
Okay.
It was so, it was such a terrible experience. It felt like I was barking orders at somebody.
Mm.
Versus me seeing somebody and having a conversation with them like we're in the same room.
Right.
It was so different. Because
you can see their expressions as they're learning. Did they actually understand what I just told them?
Yes.
Gotcha.
You know, we read stuff off of each other's faces. And so it's super important that you can see the other person's face. You have that connection with that mm-hmm. person. That's the important part, especially with learning. For me, is that there is a human element to learning and it's super important that it's there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why this is interesting to me.
Yeah. I always had this thing about, you know, when people ask a question or they want to do something and then it's sent in an email. An email is the worst way to learn.
Yep.
Because like, have you tried this? And then like several hours go by.
Oh, it's terrible.
Like, I tried this and it did that. No, wait, did you do it the way I asked you? It's like, oh, wait, oh, that's what you meant. And then several hours go by. It's horrible.
Yep.
Step up from that is, you know, chatting on Skype or whatever.
Right.
Then at least there's the several hours turns into a few minutes. There's
right.
still that confusion, but it gets less. And then yep. actually having a live phone call or a conversation, you basically take days of email and boil it down to 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And then with a facial expression, especially on a learning process, where it's like you can see the eyes going, ah, or the eyes going,
yep. yeah.
And then you can go, okay. Because sometimes you don't know. You can look at the... It was like, I don't, you know.
Yeah, if there's like a little bit of a frown, you realize that the person isn't understanding what you're doing and you have right. to go back and, you know, if their eyebrows are raising, then they right. kind of get it and they start smiling. It's like, oh, yeah, now I know what you're saying.
Right.
And I was, you know, I watch, I call them the apprentices, right? Because right. I think this is more of like an apprenticeship
yeah.
kind of thing. It's, you know, it's important for me to have that relationship with people that I mentor. And I noticed that this weekend with this girl at Full Sail, where I could watch her expression as I explained somewhat technical concepts about the lens flare node and Nuke and why it was built a certain way because I helped design it and stuff. And she's like, oh, wow, okay, now I get it. That's really cool.
Right.
I'm like, okay, now play with the sliders and break everything that I've done and you'll understand why I push the sliders to these numbers. She goes, oh, okay, cool. She goes, wow, I never would have thought to do that if you didn't walk me through that. And I could see there was like, I could see the learning happening because like you said, you can see somebody's face and you can read their facial expressions.
Yep.
And it's cool, man. And you mentioned something earlier that I think is really interesting. And that is when you see somebody learn something, it's gratifying. And it sounds really weird. There's a weird high that comes off of
oh,
it.
Oh, absolutely.
As a teacher or a mentor or whatever, when somebody takes what you're saying and understands it and then makes it their own and really learns and extrapolates from that process, man, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And, you know, that really makes me happy. And, you know, I don't know everything about everything, but some things I do know really well. And just seeing that is really cool. You know, in fact, I worked with a student a couple of years ago now, and Aaron Rovner, the guy's amazing.
Yep.
And the guy's super talented, actually used V-Ray mm-hmm. at USC, rendered out 70 shots of a hero robot character doing close-up shots.
Mm-hmm.
And when he started the work on the project, I said, whoa, what are you doing? And he told me, I'm like, okay. I said, do you want the formula on how to make this easy for yourself?
Right.
And he's like, hold on. And he gets out a notepad.
Yeah.
And he goes, tell me everything.
Right.
And so he wrote down everything that I said and like how to shoot HDRs and the whole thing and how to prep everything. I go, do this, avoid that. If you do this, you'll be able to get through all the shots.
Yep.
And he did it. And then he built on what I said. He built the nuke nodes in a certain way and then built on top of that to do his own thing. Did a lot of his stuff on his own, but he took the seed of information and right. pushed it further with what he wanted to do when he kept testing out his own ideas on it.
Sure.
But he had the base. And you know, when I saw this, you know, several minutes of footage that he put together, I was like, this is some dude. It's like amazing work. And it's just him. It right. wasn't a team of people. It was just this one guy who did all the work. It was really, really good.
Yeah. And I, you know, you actually provided, let's sort of tie your education portion back to some of the V-Ray stuff that we talked about earlier, but you actually provided the first learning material that was used for years and still is used, which people, I think, now understand, called the linear workflow.
I knew we were going to talk about that today.
Linear workflow was, to be honest, I had a hard time understanding why to use linear workflow.
Right.
Why linear light?
Sure.
You know? And now I get it. Obviously, I just like,
yeah.
Why is my monitor at 2.2 or
right.
you know, sRGB or
why is everything that I've been seeing wrong? Why is this person telling me it's all wrong?
It's all wrong.
Yeah.
And once I got it, I was like, oh. And the best explanation is like, think of a camera, you know? You double the amount of light coming in and it gets just a little bit brighter.
Right.
it's not twice as bright. It is twice as bright, but visually it's a little bit brighter.
Yeah.
And that's because it's got that exponential curve to it. And that's what linear workflow is about. And I was like, oh, I totally, totally get it. And I try to explain it to myself in several different ways. And every time I was like, oh, now I get it. I get it. I get what Rob's talking about. And that was a big thing because at the time people were just lighting everything linearly and not actually adjusting their gamma on what they were doing.
Right.
And they were overlighting everything. Everything was over contrasted.
We all had to.
Yeah.
I remember way back. So I love the old school conversation. So I remember when I first got into the linear light thing, I was working with Matt Fairclough, who wrote TerraGen.
Yeah.
And he wrote a Lightwave plugin. God, it all goes back to Lightwave, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I'll mention another Lightwave thing in a second because it all goes back to this. So I was working with Matt. And he wrote something called image space and light space, where you could convert a texture to light space versus image space.
Okay.
He was doing the sRGB conversions.
Right.
But he had his own way to do it. And it was really very similar to sRGB. And at the time, like, this was weird and strange. But I remember turning on GI and Lightwave, which was slow as hell and just barely worked.
Mm-hmm.
I turned it on and all of a sudden the single light lit up the entire room that I'd built. And I'm like, here's the answer. This is it. Everything's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
My brain finally, and I've been doing lighting for a long time, but I'd always thought like, this doesn't look right.
Yep.
When I put a light in here, even if I turn on GI, why is there not more light in the room? I don't understand. Turns out it was all a calibration problem,
right?
Which should drive everybody batshit crazy
right.
about how messed up it all was. And so I remember messing with Matt on that, and he like did some really cool stuff. And then a while later, I talked to Alan Hastings, who's the father of the Lightwave renderer and now the Modo renderer.
Right.
And I was talking to him about this stuff, and I told him about image space and light space. He goes, ugh. He goes, you know what? He goes, we had all this working in Lightwave 1.0 on the video toaster.
Right.
He said, but people said the image was too bright.
Because they weren't doing it correctly.
Yeah. And so we turned it off. I had my fruity rum drink in my hand, and I just held my head down. I'm like, ugh.
What's funny is in V-Ray, like the way that they get around it is like they just basically put the Reinhardt like curve in there
mm-hmm.
just so that it's going to light correctly, but it's burned into your image, right?
Right.
which I have a problem with. Why burn in LUTs, you know, because then you can't composite. But, you know, some people don't composite. They just render out, well, save as a JPEG, and they're done with their rendering.
When you burn in the LUT, you reduce your dynamic range,
right?
Essentially.
But basically, V-Ray is forcing you, or whatever renderer is forcing you to put in a curve into your final image.
Right.
So, yeah.
Now I think with 3, you know, I've got all my default sets, right. So I don't know what the standard defaults are anymore. But now with 3, I think that's all built in. Like, you work in linear.
You work in linear. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, even the trick, I remember this was another thing that we came up with, and it was, I think it was during the speed shape time.
Oh, yeah.
Where I came up to Vlado and I was like, you know, all of my darks are the noisiest part of the image.
Yes, I remember this.
And I said, that's the noise. It's like, that's where I'm struggling with all my stuff, because V-Ray was looking at the image in linear.
Right.
And it would, it'd say, well, there's not much noise there because everything was gammaed down, right?
Right.
So those were always noisy.
Yep.
And so I asked Vlad, I was like, can the renderer see it in sRGB in terms of noise, but still render it flat? So that's when we added, add 2.2, but keep data linear.
Yeah.
And brilliant. Like, it changed everything.
Yeah. Huge time saver. I remember render times went down.
Yeah.
Image quality went up.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, you basically, that was awesome.
And I think I actually even did a small Gnomon thing about, like, how to control your noise.
Oh, it was like a Gnomonology thing with, like, some rocks or something like that. Yeah. I remember that.
It was
about,
like, optimizing rendering noise, or optimizing noise threshold.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a big thing.
Yeah, that stuff was cool. I remember watching that because I wanted to learn. And I watched it. I was like, yep, this is good nuggets of information. Like, no question.
I actually want now, the thing is that's funny is that, you know, basically, you know, it was just an sRGB or a 2.2 would be close enough for most things. But now the crazy ass LUTs that people come up with in terms of director, they're like so out of control that I want to actually put in whatever the hell the LUT is that they're putting in there.
Right.
So my noise will be seeing how crazy the image is supposed to look like.
Right.
So it's not, because it's, you know, you're just never going to know where you're going to have noise, because, like, the highlights could be completely blown out, or, you know.
Oh, man. I mean, now at the VFB, I remember a while back, this is in 2010, we asked Vlado for the 3D LUT support.
Yeah.
And because we needed 3D LUT support, because on Priest, we were using V-Ray, obviously, 3ds Max, we had a different LUT per shot. They had done custom LUTs for every single shot in the show. We had about 75 or 80 shots.
Yeah.
And so we had to programmatically add that stuff. And so I begged him, and he did it. He was able to put it in there. And I mean, there were plates that were looking like, they looked green.
Yeah.
And when they were all done, they were like gray brown. So they had done so much hue and saturation controls that we could never replicate.
Right.
That we never would have been able to light our shots at all if it weren't for Vlado putting that in. It would have been a mess.
Right.
And in fact, other facilities had nothing but trouble getting their shots to work because of the complicated LUT setup.
Yep.
But for us, we breezed through it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And sometimes you get a LUT and it's like, here it is. And you do your render and white is like purple.
Yeah.
Or yellow.
It's like, what the hell
is
this?
What the hell is this?
Yeah.
And you put it on the plate. It's like, oh, well, I guess that makes sense. But Jesus, that looks terrible.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, that stuff is annoying. But that's, like, you know, that's what I love about the Chaos guys, is they're so responsive to that.
Yeah.
Almost
to a fault.
Yeah. But I mean, there's a lot of good software companies. You know, the Foundry is really good about that stuff too.
Yeah.
Chaos is really good. You know, there's a lot of people who really respond to their users.
Yeah.
And
well, they're excited to do cool things, right?
Right.
So I mean, that's the motivation there, is that they're in it because they. I mean, I Vlado is so responsive to almost everyone in a lot of ways, to that a lot of people just think that, a lot of people still to this day think that we've got like 2 or 3 developers.
Yeah,
and it's mostly Vlado.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. There's like 60 of them or 50 of them or something like that. You know, it's insane, right?
Yeah.
And there's so many of them, but it's because he's so involved in what the user wants and he gets so passionate about it. He does. Like, that's his thing. It's about what do they want and why do they want, and getting involved, and just that's what's driven him for the last, you know, 15 years or whatever it's been.
Yeah, I had a little email exchange with him about scanned materials, and I'm like, I want to put maps in it.
Right.
But you can't.
Right.
But there's got to, you know, we'll figure out a way to do it.
Right.
He's like, do some blend materials in this, and we're thinking about it. I'm like, yep, I want the BRDF.
Right.
But for, you know, for things like, let's say game cinematics of right. a sci-fi spaceship. Well, right. I don't know. I can't go scan the sci-fi spaceship that doesn't exist.
Right. Yep.
You know, I could never get access to that. But I know it's going to be some kind of metallic surface. So let me go scan a bunch of metallic surfaces. And I want that BRDF. But I want to be able to put decals on it and dirt.
Right.
So I should be able to take like a dirt scan
right.
with that yep. BRDF and the metal scan and blend them together with the color of each one of them. And kind of put it together and then put some like decals in the dirt. There should be ways to do that. So there it's coming. I know it's going to show up
right.
as soon as, you know.
Well, those are going to be questions that are going to come up yeah. because that's the use cases, right? Because that's what always happens at Casco. They come up with some crazy thing.
Yeah.
And they put it out in the world. And sometimes people don't even know it's there and it just stays there.
Yeah.
And sometimes people look, oh, yeah, and then they just, I want this, I want this, I want that. And it's like, they'll do it, you know?
Sure.
And that's the way to be honest, like in anyone who uses software, especially, you know, advanced software of any kind, that is cutting edge software.
Sure.
Your role as a user is not to use the software. Your role as a user is to use it so much that you want to do other things with it.
Right.
And then therefore your responsibility is to go back to tell the people what you want. And the best part of it is that you probably will get it.
Yeah, and I mean, I have the unfortunate ability to break every piece of software that I use.
You're very good at that.
It's a mess. I think one of the people that I work with called me like the best beta tester of all time.
Yeah,
because I break everything.
Yep.
Even the software. I remember I was using Zinc, and they're like, "This software works great. It never fails." 2 minutes into the software, it completely broke for me.
Right.
I broke it instantaneously. Yep. They're like, "How did you do it?" I'm like, "Sorry. I told you when I signed onto the platform, I was going to break it constantly. And sure enough, I broke that platform constantly.
Right.
But they fixed it and they made it way better. Now right. Google bought them.
Right.
I've heard of Google. There's some company they do
yeah,
some.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I use to search for trees and stuff. Yeah. Right. They're the tree searching company.
That's the tree
I think searching. They do some other stuff too. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's, you know, you're right about the software and the uses. Like push the software as hard as you can. Make it yep. do weird things it was never intended to do. Break it. And that's how software developers like get to know you.
Yeah, my wife worked at the Museum of Natural Science in Houston way, way back when, and they were doing this touchscreen things for the museum for kids to use or whatever. And it was like great. And so it was like we need to try it out. So she went to it and just smacked it all over the screen. Oh, smack, 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 and it broke. It's like, well, you're not supposed to use it. And it was like,
okay,
I'm 3 years old. That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah, of course.
It's like
the 3 year old is not going to be dainty.
You don't want the first, you know, first user, a 3 year old, to use this, and it's going to break, and you're going to go, well, you're not supposed to use that. You're supposed to only touch it here.
You know, yeah, I mean, like pick your nose, rub the booger on it. Yeah. That's what the 3 year old is going to do.
Yep.
You got to mimic that.
You got to do that exactly.
That's funny. Yeah. No. Of course.
Well, cool. We are at about the right amount of time here. Is there anything else you want to talk about before we sign off?
Nothing springs to mind. Yeah. But of course, it'll spring to mind the minute you turn off the microphone.
Well, that's fine. We can talk about that later. But,
yeah, yeah.
But everything else is going great for you. Obviously, you're busy now. You're working in the gaming industry. Am I correct?
Yeah, I'm over at Activision right now.
Yeah.
And finished working on Guitar Hero.
Nice.
The LOL live action Guitar Hero. It's going to be really cool.
Yep.
What a man. That game is fun to play. Let me tell you. The old game I was not into as much because it just never resonated with me.
Right.
But now that it's all live action and that you're the guitarist and you look out into the crowd and the crowd reacts to what you're doing and throws stuff at you if you suck. Amazing.
Nice.
Super engaging.
Nice.
It's the biggest visual effects show of all time
yeah.
with about 370 minutes of finished visual effects work.
Whoa.
Yep. Crazy. Absolutely wow. crazy. 300. Yeah, maybe it's just a little under 400. I know
right.
that. And doing it in, you know, 9 months or so.
Wow.
I don't quite know how it's all going to get done.
Sure. Well, that's the gaming industry, right?
So yeah. I mean, it's just, stuff. I mean, it's an unbelievable amount of work and Framestore is just like just rocking it on that stuff. They're really doing a great job.
Cool.
So a lot of credit to those guys. And then I've got another project that I'm working on over there.
Nice.
And obviously, you know, the live mentoring thing, which I'm super excited about that.
Yeah. Well, that's you great. Know. Well, that's great. I think our rendering's about come to a close. We got a couple of buckets left.
But, yeah.
We're going to let the last bucket drop here. And thanks a lot. I appreciate it, Rob.
Hey, thank you so much, Chris. It's always good to be here.